Before we moved to Philadelphia, what were the laboratory facilities like at Illinois when you were doing research, your PhD work?
Well, they were, by today's standards, they were pretty primitive, you know. OSHA could never have approved anything that was going on there. There was no such thing as the kind of ventilation that you're supposed to have and so forth. And the kind of sophistication that was going, it was available to you to do this kind of chemistry was minimal. I mean, infrared wasn't being used all that much even, you know. Certainly there was no NMR or anything else. And X-ray diffractometers were not in existence and so forth. So that it was just at least in the research that I was doing and that most people were doing in terms of synthesis and reactions, it was just glassware of the ordinary classical type that was being used. In my case, it was aqueous chemistry, so it was just solution chemistry, and compounds were not air sensitive or anything else, so you could just use ordinary flasks and beakers and so forth.
Did you measure, because you did a lot of it very early on when you came here, did you measure any absorption spectra in Illinois, or was that still too early?
No, that was just at the beginning of measuring absorption spectra, and I did do some, just a few spectra of some platinum complexes, that's right, but it was sort of a primitive kind of thing.
Yep. I was going to ask you how you, the reason is that this year is the 50th anniversary of the DU.
Oh, yes.
Which would have been 41, so that's right, started coming out in late 41.
Mm-hmm.
So did you have a DU? Is that what you were using?
Yes, I can't even remember the instrument that we used. And I used it in conjunction with somebody else who was actually doing spectroscopic kind of things.
I see.
And so I was not all that knowledgeable about what kind of instrument it was. And I don't remember it being a DU, though. My first instrument that I used when I got here was a Beckman DU.
Well, that's why I was curious,
yeah.
Asking that. What if you were not using a DU, what you were using?
I can't recall what predated the DU, but there must have been something in Illinois that some of the physical chemists were doing in getting UV visible spectra.
Well, there was a GE put out an instrument that was developed by Hardy. I'm not sure. Would your measurements been in the ultraviolet? Would you have gone down that far?
I would have certainly gone near ultraviolet.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, because these platinum compounds are virtually colorless, so
All
you
right.
would have had to be.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Now there wasn't much available. It was simplified before the DU. That was,
now that's it. I don't think this was, and I think it was the sort of thing where. You know, you know your fellow graduate students, and you say, look, I'd like to have a spectrum of this thing, and you go down and bring your solution with you and hang around. And my thesis, I'm sure, has two or three spectra in it, but it probably doesn't tell you anything about the instrument.
I've noticed in many papers at that time that frequently the authors will say, we thank so-and-so for the measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it stops, so you get no idea, because I've been interested in that part of the history of it, pre-DU spectroscopy.
Yeah, that's interesting now that you mention it.
And it's very frustrating to look at a paper and say, we thank so-and-so for the measurements, but no indication of
how they were made. Maybe that's what's in my thesis, as far as I know.
How theoretical was your... Theoretical inorganic chemistry, certainly in its infancy. But how theoretical was your training at Illinois?
Well, mine was not. Mine was not at all, because going in the direction that I did, and I also ended up, you had to take courses outside, at least one or two courses. And I taught, being an inorganic chemist, I took ceramics, actually. And some of the people in Illinois, of course, as physical chemists, would take a bath or things like this, but I didn't. And so as far as the theory was concerned, We just simply use seat-of-the-pants kind of valence bond theory to explain structures, magnetic properties, and so forth as best we could of these Wernicke complexes. Mm-hmm. And in those days, that was what you had. I mean, in retrospect, that wasn't all that we had. But the coordination chemists didn't learn about crystal field theory until later, although the physicists knew about crystal field theory at the same time that Pauling's valence bond theory appeared, and even before. But since chemists were not reading physics journals, and they were not aware of crystal field theory until back until in the 50s, actually, the early 50s. Mm-hmm.
The problem you worked on, did Baylor assign that, or did you select it from a list of things?
Well, Baylor suggested that here were two or three things that that he was interested in, and allowed me to select the one that I thought I'd be most interested in. In fact, I think there were two. We ended up sort of doing what we could with one of the problems, and it didn't seem to be going anywhere, and then we backed off and worked on the other one, and that one did at least result in a couple of publications.
Yes, you had a paper in 1950 which was based on your thesis, but there was a woman on that paper.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, Betty Raptar, that's right. She predated me, and we overlapped just a little bit, but not all that much. I just overlapped enough. She was, I think, in her last year as a graduate student when I was just getting started. But the work that she had done had to be carried a little further before it would be publishable, and that's what I did. So,
what did she? Two questions, I guess. What did she go on to do, and were there many other women at Illinois at that time?
No, there weren't many women, and I don't know that I've ever heard any more about Betty Raptar after she left. I really don't know that whether she went into industry or just what she did.
What kind of person was Baylor to work for?
I think he was superb. I mean, he's the type of person I think that I would want to work for. I mean, he was interested in the work, so he would always be available. He in those days was not traveling all that much, so he was there much of the time. And when he was there, he would always drop by the lab and inquire as to what was going on. But he wouldn't necessarily be dropping by the lab to check up on how much you've accomplished and what you're going to do next and so forth. He would just come by to interact socially and professionally and give you an opportunity to ask questions and to tell him what you've done and what you're planning to do. So it was an ideal arrangement.
Was there much war-related work going on at that time?
Yes, there was, particularly as summer jobs. In those days, you know, we had TAs, and that was an academic year thing. I think the salary was $65 a month. But during the summer, you could take a summer job. And during the war, some of that was government-sponsored research. I mean, Speed Marvel had all this synthetic rubber kind of thing going on. But Audriot and the inorganic chemists had fluorophosphonates and nerve gases and all kinds of nasty things going on and so forth.
Did you work on some of that?
I did not. I was able to continue with my research, and I think I'd gotten a university fellowship or something, so that whatever it was, I did not do any of that. Yeah.
Was your reaction when you got to the big city of Philadelphia in 1943?
Well, that also was a big time for me anyway. And I worked at this research lab of theirs in one of the suburbs called Brightsburg, which is right along the river. And it's a pretty ethnic Polish place, you know, with all the taverns and everything else. It's a sort of was and still is, I guess, a pretty much of a slum manufacturing area. But anyway, I wasn't married, and there were other people like myself, just really waiting for the war to be over. And I, you know, that was a war that we supported. And it wasn't easy for a person my age to be a civilian, because my father was dying of cancer, and on two different occasions I was called home, and you'd go down to North Philly and get on the train, take the train to Chicago, and those trains were wall-to-wall people, and people my age were all in uniform, and you'd have to be in the train sitting next to somebody whose husband had already been killed, or whose son had been murdered, or at least they were out in Guadalcanal or some such place. So it was an uncomfortable thing, and some of my colleagues actually went in and volunteered and got officer's rating, and I was tempted once or twice, but I finally decided, gee, they must know what they want me to do. So I would get these greetings always, you know, to go in for a physical, pass a physical, wait to be called as a GI, and then at the last moment they would defer me again. And then we'd go through this again and again, and eventually, of course, the war was over. So I never did go to war.
Did the company, was the company behind those deferments, do you think?
Well, I think the fact that the company was doing this war research, this classified thing, and the work that I was on, I guess, might have been important. And we succeeded in doing what we were asked to do. We were supposed to make synthetic mica, and we actually succeeded in making a material which could be used as synthetic mica. It never turned out to be commercialized, because it's the natural mica, the source of natural mica never was was always available, I guess, in the U.S., so they didn't have to rely on this, but they could have if they had had to rely on it. So there were those kinds of things, and I guess, sure, the deferment would come because of whatever the priority rating of such research was.
Who was your boss at Roman Haas?
Oh, there's a guy by the name of Lorne Hurd, who had gotten his degree at Wisconsin. Can't remember who he'd worked with at Wisconsin, but he was the boss. Yeah, Lorne Hurd. Don't know what ever happened to him.
And were there many people in the group you were in?
There were two other PhDs from MIT in our lab, and then the other people were non-degree people, I guess, the bachelors or what have you. They were assistants of one type or another. So the lab probably had 8 or 10 people in it, but only three of us, plus Hurd, of course, four of us.
How did that MICA project take the whole 3 years that you were there?
No. They were in zirconia pacifiers, zirconium dioxide. And so they had a lot of zirconium minerals and so forth, and they were trying to make zirconium derivatives of one type or another in waterproofing fabric and things like this. So that I did at some stage get asked to work on the synthesis of some zirconium compounds that might be of interest. And so I spent some time doing that as well.
Had you thought, as the war was coming to an end, had you thought about what you wanted to do when the war was over? Were you to stay in industry? Or?
Yeah, I think I probably knew even when I went there that I would want to, when it was all over, have an academic job of some sort, because I guess I came up through normal university with thinking even in terms of high school teaching and so forth. And I had taken such a liking to Nickers and to John Baylor that I sort of thought that it would be nice to be in a position akin to what they were doing. And so all of the 3 years that I was there, actually, it was really a good time for me to think in terms of an academic position and what I might do if I, when this was all over. And although my work with John Baylor was on synthesis reactions and stereochemistry of these kinds of compounds, I did have a chance to go to the library and read about some of what the physical organic chemists were doing in terms of their physical organic chemistry, solvolysis, kinetics and mechanisms, SN1 and SN2. And it just seemed logical to me that the same kinds of things could be done with some of the compounds that I was familiar with. And so I really had a pretty good idea what I wanted to do the day I arrived here. And perhaps that was the reason that things took off rather quickly. And we were able to tackle this problem. And fortunately, as I say, it was fortunate for both of us. Ralph Pearson was here, and after a year or two, I was able to seduce him into doing this rather than doing physical organic.
What kind of things were you reading? Reading Hammett's book?
That kind of thing, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Why did you, as an inorganic chemist, why did you pick that kind of thing to read?
Well, I can't recall exactly, except that it was a book that seemed to be something about organic chemistry that wasn't just the Diels-Alder reaction. You know, coming to Illinois in those days, I remember the end of the first year when we had to take this qualifying exam in each of the four areas. The organic chemistry one was being taught in those days, not in terms of mechanisms so much, but it was being taught in terms of name reactions. And I had made index cards of name reactions with the name on one side and the reaction on the opposite side. And I must add, bunch of them that thick. And in preparing for this this qualifying exam at the end of the first year, I kept going through these cards, and as soon as the stack that I got correct got bigger than the stack that I got wrong, I decided I was ready for the exam. So I think when I looked at Hammett's book, and I looked probably at some review papers, and it looked like there were people doing things other than that kind of organic chemistry, it struck my fancy, and particularly the solvolysis type reactions were pretty straightforward and kinds of things that I could appreciate, and it just kind of triggered that kind of interest.
You left German Haas in 1946. What were the circumstances around that? Were you in a position to leave after the war was over? Did you go out searching for a position, or were they terminating employment at the end of the war?
No, I don't think they were terminating employment. I think we could have stayed, and some people did stay. But a few of us did leave, those of us who really wanted academic positions. In my case, as another in my colleagues' cases who were there also who left, at this point, you know, the GIs were coming back, and they were all going to universities. And the universities found that the enrollments were such that they had to get out and get more faculty. So there were an abundance of faculty positions available, and I think I applied a few places. And again, the one that I really looked at seriously was this one, because by that time I felt it would be nice to get back to the state of Illinois again. And I didn't know all that much about Northwestern, but when I came here, there was really no inorganic chemistry other than P.W. Selwood. He was an inorganic chemist, had been trained by B.S. Hopkins of Illinois on rare earth chemistry, but actually Selwood was doing heterogeneous catalysis and that kind of chemistry. And the fellow that was the inorganic chemist here had just accepted a job, I think, at the University of Colorado Boulder. And so the junior-senior level course that he had been teaching in inorganic chemistry something that they needed a faculty person for, and it sounded exciting to me to have an opportunity to step in and teach that course. In those days, there was not even a textbook of inorganic chemistry. Moeller had not yet written.
That's
it,
right. I used Moeller.
That's
I
right.
Remember
so
that
the, so I made up my own notes, you know, Emilius and Anderson, and several books that were around, and did the best I could. And I enjoyed teaching that course. And I think that course was also very helpful in getting graduate students here to go into inorganic chemistry, because
was it required of them?
It was a course that was taught at the undergraduate level, and it was taught in the fall quarter, and we had students coming, as we always do, from all sorts of places, coming from schools where they did not in those days have such a course. They just didn't have an inorganic course at the junior, senior level, all the whatever inorganic was just in the general chemistry. So those students were really required to take this course, or they did take this course. And in this course, as a result of their taking it when they first arrived, I was able to brainwash a few of them and get them interested in organic chemistry. Let me try and get somebody to get you for me here or play with me before it's too late.
Well, we were talking about your move to Northwestern. What was the situation in the department? How large was it, and what kind of facilities did they have?
Well, the department was certainly smaller than it is now, but not all that much smaller in terms of numbers of faculty. In terms of the university enrollment on this campus, it wasn't all that much different than it is now. But in terms of graduate students, number of graduate students, it certainly was smaller. And in terms of inorganic graduate students, it was zero, of course. And the situation that that I found at that time, of course, was that the at least in my particular case, I did have the access to a Beckman DU spectrophotometer. By then, we were doing absorption spectra and following spectral changes in order to follow these reactions. And we had a conductivity bridge that we could also follow these reactions. And we had a polarimeter that we could use when the organic chemists weren't using. If we had some optically active compounds that we wanted to monitor. And we had practically no funds, because there was nothing other than research corporations. So after a year or two, I think I got a research corporation grant and the like. So most of our people were on TAs, and we don't have that many TAs, so that you couldn't support large numbers of graduate students.
Who were the shall I put this? Who were the stars of the department at the time?
Sure. Charles Hurd, of course, was the senior person, I guess, and very well known in organic chemistry and pyrolysis and so forth. The very active group was also Herman Pines and the Padieff in their catalysis lab, and that not only because they were doing good work, but also because of the fact that the catalysis was important in industry. But in universities, no place other than Northwestern was really doing heterogeneous catalysis in the same sense that it was being done here. Most of that kind of work in those days was being done in industry, practically no work of that type in universities. So Northwestern has had this long sort of thing with the heterogeneous catalysis. A lot of universities now, of course, are doing it. But in any case, and in physical chemistry, the guy that that really was well known and became even better known is Malcolm Dole, of course, who was here.
Yes.
And he was a fabulous person, you know, did a variety of things in terms of his research in the glass electrode. He even wrote a book on the subject. He did electrochemistry, wrote a book on the subject. He did oxygen isotopes and got our standard change, you know, from oxygen to carbon 12. And then finally, even within polymer chemistry and radiation of polymers and branching radiation things and calorimetry of some of these things. So those were the people here that were most productive in terms of research.
If Patty F. died when, late in the early 50s, I think. Any contact with him? Or?
Practically none. I mean, his English never really was all that good, and his research interest was different from mine. And so I would see him, and I knew that this was the Russian professor, you know, and so forth. But really didn't have much contact.
Who was chairman of the department?
A fellow by the name of Somerville when I arrived. And just before that was a guy by the name of Ward Evans. Ward Evans was a physical chemist, and in fact, he was the mentor of Ralph Pearson. Pearson did his thesis work here with Ward Evans. And then Ward Evans left here and went to Loyola here in Chicago. And I think it was because he'd reached the magic age of retirement here, so he went there. And Somerville took it on. But Ward Evans, his claim to fame was not his physical chemistry so much. His claim to fame was he was on the Oppenheimer Tribunal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he wrote the minority report that they should not strip him of all of his classified things. He should still have access to all this and so forth and so on. So that was his big achievement, I guess.
And then was Whitmore his predecessor?
And Whitmore was, I guess, prior to that, and that's really before I got
here.
Yeah.
Did you teach anything else besides this junior, senior level course when you first came?
General chemistry.
Yeah.
And in those days, we were not only teaching general chemistry, and I didn't start right out giving lectures in it, but Somerville, who was an organic chemist and chairman of the department, he liked to teach general chemistry, so he took on most of the bulk of the teaching, and the rest of us were sort of his assistants, and we would take the quiz classes, We weren't using graduate students in those days here because, well, one reason was Somerville thought that the graduate students were not capable of doing this and doing it as well as he would like, and he kept pointing out that here we are, private institution charging these large tuitions and competing with state schools, and at least we ought to give the students a little more for their money than they get when they go to state school, so we ought to have regular faculty doing the quiz classes. And during his tenure as chairman, that's exactly what was done. Yeah.